Hello and welcome to the IRPP's Interview with the Author series. My name is Nicola Johnston and today I am joined by my guest, Thomas Korshain. He's the Jaroslawsky George Professor of Economic and Financial Policy and a member of the Department of Economics at the School of Policy Studies and the Faculty of Law at Queen's University. He is author of the new essay, Policy Signposts in Postwar Canada, Reflections of a Market Populist, published by the Institute for Research on Public Policy as part of its 40th anniversary celebrations. We joined him today in Kingston. Welcome, Professor Korshain.
Thank you.
So your paper provides a sweeping overview of Canadian policy signposts spanning the post-war period to today and covers just about the full spectrum of Canadian policy issues. It's indeed an original paper, and you've divided it into two distinct sections with signposts that look back at the era of American hegemony and then forward to the informatics era, as you put it. Can you tell us why you decided to structure the paper this way?
Sure, but let me first back up a bit and note that the discussion of the selection of the signposts is not factual and analytical. Rather, the choice is quite subjective, and this is why the subtitle there is a subtitle, and it's as you referred to it, it's Reflections of a Market Populist, where market populism essentially means a belief in markets complemented by a generous social envelope. Now, others with a different vantage point or different societal ideology would choose differently, and indeed, perhaps those with my own ideology would select differently. Mm-hmm. So, with that as an introduction, let me turn now to your question that. As I worked through the historic evolution of Canadian policy, it struck me that there were two overarching frameworks that were driving the whole process. The first was the era of American supremacy or American hegemony, essentially from the end of the Second World War to the fall of the Soviet Empire. The second, and partially overlapping, was what I call the informatics era, which really began with the Reagan-Thatcher revolution that led to the ongoing regime of unfettered global capitalization, global capitalism. Now, under the umbrella of American hegemony, I selected seven signposts, including the decentralization of the Canadian Federation, the Tommy Douglas, Lester Pearson remaking of Social Canada, the transformation of Quebec from duplicity to the Quiet Revolution to the separatist movement, the patriation of the Constitution and the Charter, immigration and multiculturalism, and finally the transformation of Canadian North American economic space via FTA and NAFTA. Now, the feature of the informatics era, the second framework, the informatics era, includes the rise of the internet and the network, which is the technological basis for the informatics era. It's replete with the advent of what we call global supply chain and the importance of human capital relative to physical capital. So the signposts in this era are quite different. They include the transformation of global economic space. First of all, the decline of American hegemony that defined the first order, and then the rise of China and India and others. It includes the so-called maple leaf miracles on Canada's macroeconomic front, our fiscal, monetary, and financial achievements that no one else in the G7 has been able to match. The ongoing and dramatic role of natural resources in transforming our economy and our federation, and the equally remarkable political transformation from the so-called Laurentian model of centered in Ontario and Quebec to the new conservative model, which the West is in, as many people call it. And finally, our own version of the Cold War, namely the socio-economic and geopolitical challenges associated with the Canadian Arctic. And so that completes the signposts. And if one were to devote a sentence to distinguish the difference between these two, it would be along the following lines, that in the post-war era, this was a time when international economic integration proceeded at the same time or apace with domestic social economic integration. This is in sharp contrast to the informatics era, where the challenge is to ensure that the ongoing international economic integration does not lead to domestic social disintegration. So that's how I would. That's my overview of what I think I did.
And so let's discuss the first signpost then, embedded liberalism and American supremacy. So can you tell us how the age of American supremacy influenced the major policy turning points in Canada?
Yes. Well, first of all, the Americans, as well as us, but I'm talking about the Americans here, emerged from the war with their domestic infrastructure largely intact, unlike Europe and Japan. So almost by default, they became the workshop of the world. Thus, it was it turned out that it's in its own self-interest to ensure that other countries could also prosper, because Americans wanted to sell all their goods to these other countries. So the Americans played a lead role in recreating the global order, right from the Marshall Plan to help the Europeans, to the gold exchange standard, to leading players in the IMF and the World Bank and the GATT, ensuring currency convertibility, etc. So with hindsight, if the Americans made one error, it was that they were so rich that even unskilled labor could become middle-class Americans or achieve the American dream. Mm-hmm. And because of that, the undereducated, I think, they're the bottom half of their labor force. And so when the global supply chains of the informatics era came along, these workers were sort of ready to be offshored and outsourced, unlike the German middle-class technologists, which the Chinese just couldn't duplicate.
Mm-hmm.
So Canada was the beneficiary of all of this. And we followed, for example, the Kennedy-Johnson social policy transformation by having our own, Tommy Douglas, Lester Pearson transformation. But beyond this, our closeness to the U.S. allowed us to punch well beyond our weight internationally. The best example of this is we became a member of the G7. Without the U.S. support, we would never have been able to achieve that. But even a more impressive way in which we benefited from American hegemony was that for several years in the end of the hegemony period, we topped the international rankings of the United Nations Index of the most livable nation on Earth, and that was an enormous accomplishment to be right on top of this global ranking.
And so let's turn now to the latter portion of the paper in signpost 11, which is particularly interesting. You discuss natural resources and the transformation of the Canadian economy in Federation. So what are some of the opportunities and pitfalls facing Canada as it ponders resource development into the future?
Well, I mean, this is a huge opportunity for Canada, because not only Canadians, but the globe is inviting us to become one of the world's resource superpowers. So not surprisingly, there's a move afoot to develop a resource-based industrial strategy, and that's generating excitement across many sectors. The federal government, obviously, in terms of some of the initiatives in the budget, obviously also the resource-based provinces. Banks are dramatically excited about this, so is business, and I think arguably a majority of Canadians think that the resources should play a major role. However, the resource challenge is, in my view, the most complex issue that Canada as a whole has ever had to come to grips with. And in this essay, I emphasize many of these issues, but two of them in particular. One of them is that is the presence of the Dutch disease, and namely that the increase in international capital inflows from not only oil exports but foreign direct investment in our energy sector and resource sector has led to an appreciation of the exchange rate with highly deleterious impacts on manufacturing. So we're getting a quite dramatic transformation of the economic of capital of Canada away from the center and towards the resource regions. The second is related in the sense that there are now huge increases in provincial revenues accruing to the resource provinces. So as a result, after equalization, although Alberta doesn't get equalization, but after all equalization is in, Alberta now has per capita revenues or fiscal capacity of $12,700 compared to, say, just over $7,000 for Ontario, or 80% more than Ontario has. Hence, the stage is set for these energy-intensive provinces to become either tax havens or superior producers of public goods and services, or likely both. In other words, the result is we are heading in the direction of a massive strain on our federation, especially in terms of interprovincial equity. Now, this essay I present a few possibilities for moving this this industrial strategy away from being largely a regional strategy and towards embracing more of a national economic strategy, so that the political and provincial antagonism towards such a shift would not come into play.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Professor Korshain. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thomas Korshain is the Gerald Loewski Deutsch Professor of Economic and Financial Policy and a member of the Department of Economics at the School of Public Policy Studies and the Faculty of Law at Queen's University. He is the author of the new essay, Policy Signposts in Postwar Canada, Reflections of a Market Populist, published by the Institute for Research on Public Policy as part of its 40th anniversary celebrations. The study is available free of charge from our website at www.irpp.org. We join Thomas Korshain in Kingston today.